Imagine we have one particle. And we're talking about the probability of finding that particle with momentum p and position r. That probability can be expressed in terms of the delta function that requires p to be equal to the coordinate of that particle and requires p to be equal to the momentum of that particle and r to be equal to the coordinate of that particle. This definition then says we take the average over some distribution of p and r and we get this probability. If we integrate this over p and r, this is just the integral of the delta function, and we get 1. For example, if we have a Hamiltonian for this particle, which is p squared over 2m, or pj squared over 2m, plus u of rj, then the distribution function has this probability distribution function has the form rho of p and r equal to e to the minus beta times this Hamiltonian, which depends on pj and rj, divided by some partition function, which is a normalizing factor, and makes this be true. Since beta multiplies the Hamiltonian, the derivative with respect to beta, with a minus sign, this is minus beta multiplying the Hamiltonian, of the logarithm of the partition function is the average of the Hamiltonian. When we talked about n particles previously, we evaluated this partition function, and we found that it was equal to the volume of the system times 2 pi m, Boltzmann constant, times temperature raised to the 3/2 power. Boltzmann constant times temperature is 1 over beta, so that if we calculate this average, we find out by doing the derivative of this logarithm. Of course, the volume of the system falls out. The only thing that matters is this factor. And we end up with 3/2 the Boltzmann constant times temperature, which is, of course, the result of the equal partition theorem. Next comes n particles. We define a distribution function for this case, f of p and r, which is very similar to this rho of p and r, except that it has a sum in it. It is the sum over all particles of the statistical average of the delta function of r minus rj and the delta function of p minus pj. Since these are dynamical quantities, rj and pj depend on time, this distribution function could also be a function of time, and it is often written as f of p, r, and t. However, we're going to be considering a time-independent situation today, and so I don't put in the time dependence. Of course, because of this summation, we have the condition that the integral, the PDR of f of p and r and no time, is equal to the number of particles in the system. And if all the particles are the same, n times rho of r and t is f rho of p and r. It's f of p and r. I'm about to do a calculation which involves using this f of p and r. I'm going to calculate the pressure in the system. Is this clear? Problem with this? My wife told me that I should tell you all how pleased I am with you. You guys catch me in all my errors. You get me to talk about the things where I've been a little bit sloppy or a lot sloppy, and you're alive. I like that. I appreciate it. Pressure calculation. So I want to imagine a wall of the system. I'm going to think about particles moving with momentum p, where p has three components, px, py, and pz. And I'm going to make this the x direction. I'm going to ask something about the particles that hit the wall within the interval dt. I'm going to ask about something that happens within the piece of area dA of the wall. In fact, the pressure times dA times dt is the momentum transferred to the wall in, or to the portion of the wall, to the portion of the wall of area dA in time interval dt. It is a force, but forces are transfer of momentum. What we can imagine is we have particles coming along, and these particles come in and hit the wall. Here are a couple of trajectories of the particles. I'm going to imagine that these particles are moving to some extent downward, and to some extent that way, and to some extent that way, but I'm not going to do anything with that coordinate at all. So there's a little piece, dA, of area. All the particles within the interval px over m, that's the velocity, times dt, this is a length. All the particles within this length will hit the wall. They will hit the wall, and then they bounce back. So we're going to assume elastic collisions. And now I am about to calculate the momentum transfer to the wall. So, the pressure times dA times dt, which is the momentum transfer to the wall, is the integral over all p, having px greater than 0, of f of p and r and no time, px greater than 0 because we're looking at the particles coming in and hitting the wall. They then transfer the momentum 2 times px to the wall. 2 because they come bouncing back with the same momentum as they came in. The number of particles that we have are the number of particles in the volume formed by dA times that length, and that length is px over m times dt. And now we are essentially done with the calculation. We calculate what we have here, and out will come the pressure. I apologize for symbols P and P, but I have written this P differently from this one. This is the vector momentum anyhow. And now I'm about to do the calculation. I will drop the condition Px greater than 0 and drop this 2. That, since half the particles have Px greater than 0 and half the particles have Px less than 0, that's no big deal. I will write instead of then, well, I write Px squared over m here, and then times 2 times dA times dt. But I might as well cancel out this a dA times dt. But don't let me forget the f of p, r, and no time. And we then find that the pressure is the integral dp of p squared, the momentum squared, divided by 3m. I said p squared is px squared plus py squared plus pz squared. There are three terms that look like this, and there is no reason why I shouldn't have a one-third there. And then we have an f of p, r, and t. However, p squared over 2m is the energy which we just calculated. So this is the average of the energy for a single particle times the number of particles, so it's the average of the total Hamiltonian, times 2/3. The 2 comes because it's p squared over 2m. The 3 is just rewriting this. And this then is 2/3 Got to be careful here. Being careful requires the eraser. Help, eraser, someone. Ah, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. This is the integral dp, p squared over 2m times 3/2, e to the minus beta p squared over 2m divided by the partition function, which is appropriate. In this case, we have a z factor down here, and because f is n times larger than rho, we have an n factor here. I turned it 2/3 over. Can't I? Am I not allowed to turn things over? 2/3. Thank you. A little help from my friends. I'll get a 3/2 from that. Of course, we're going to want pressure that doesn't have a coefficient in it, but that's neither here nor there. Z is the volume of the system times 2 pi mkt to the 3 halves. This p squared over 2m has the average of 3 halves nkt. So we will just put in the 3 halves nkt. This 2 thirds. This omega. And the integral which is left, integral dp e to the minus beta p squared over 2m, is the integral from which we got that. So that cancels out. And we are left with, multiplying through by omega, p times omega is nkt, the perfect gas law. Now, this is an elementary calculation from what is called kinetic theory. Kinetic theory means you keep your eye on the particles and watch what they're doing. You then, when you have to calculate a probability distribution, you make use of Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution functions or the like. I point out to you that this factor is interesting and connects with something that you were hearing about in the last lecture. Not my last lecture, the last lecture 20 minutes ago. What we're calculating is the current of momentum which hits the wall. This is the current of momentum coming into the wall, the momentum going this way less the momentum going that way. What we're basically doing is doing a calculation which looks at the conservation law for momentum. Among the crucial things that happen that we want to keep an eye on in the system is how the conservation laws work out. And the pressure is all about the conservation law for momentum. In fact, there is a stress energy tensor. And I was a little too late to come in and see whether or not the stress energy tensor was on the blackboard. Was the stress energy tensor on the blackboard in the previous lecture? No. Okay, not today. The pressure is the diagonal element of the stress energy tensor, which you are going to see in your field theory lectures in the next week, I bet. If you don't, you'll see a little later. The pressure then is a diagonal element in the stress tensor, which describes how a momentum moves through the system. Okay, we're done with that topic. Let's see where we are. If there are questions about that topic, I'm perfectly happy to answer them. Yes, please.
Yeah, in the top line of the term, you underline 2 pi x. Where does the 2 from that go, going to the next line?
This 2 and this 2? Those 2s are 2?
On the top line on the board.
This term.
Yeah, that 2.
I have this condition.
Right, going to the next line, you drop
the next line, I then drop that 2 because I have just as many particles going that way. It's that way.
Okay, so you integrate over the entire.
So I integrate over the entire distribution. That's how come I can use the thing that we remembered, that the average of p squared over 2m is 3 halves nkt. Okay? Now I'm going to go back and talk for a little bit about the fundamentals of probability theory. Not that one, this one. Imagine we have two things going on. One of them is I'm shooting a trap, I'm shooting dice, and I have outcomes. Alpha is 1, 2, up to whatever we finish with. The other, maybe I'm flipping a coin, and I have outcomes. Gamma is heads and tails, or whatever we want. I want to ask, how many times is it that we get, let's say we have n events, the events are composite events. We do both. N is the total number of events. N alpha gamma is the number of times, excuse me, I'm getting tangled on that, alpha and gamma turn up. So I'm a winner if I get my crap come out, my dice come out with 1, 3, and my coin come out with a heads, and that's what this represents, the number of times that this happens. Now, there's a concept called a conditional probability, the number of times alpha and gamma comes up is the probability of alpha and gamma times n. However, one could also think of it in the following way. It is the probability that alpha will come up given gamma. Let me write that out. Probability of alpha, if you know gamma, has come up, times the number of times gamma comes up. That's n alpha gamma. I write this down because I want to talk about a situation of statistical independence. What does it mean for one thing to be independent of the other? A moment of speculation or talk about what physics is all about. Physics, at least traditional physics, is all about splitting things up into composite systems. Splitting things up so that we have relatively simple systems that are isolated. So we have alpha thought about and we can ignore gamma because they're statistically independent of one another. That is, we would like to have things which don't depend on one another. There is a philosophical issue of the extent to which this is possible in the world, but surely physics uses models in which a whole world is thrown out and there's just some tiny little simple thing. And that depends on this concept of independence. Rho alpha given gamma is said to have statistical independence of gamma if this doesn't depend on gamma. Independent of gamma. And we would like to talk about problems in which there is a lot of statistical independence. That is, problems in which n alpha gamma is a product of things depending on alpha and on gamma, but not upon any complicated combination of them. In fact, we see that all the time in our discussion of statistical mechanics. We talk about probability distributions being proportional to e to the minus beta times the Hamiltonian. This structure is right, not because Maxwell intuited it, nor because necessarily because Boltzmann saw an argument which gave it, but in part because it has the right mathematical structure. If we have a Hamiltonian, which is a sum of pieces, Hj, then the probability distribution, which is proportional e to the minus beta h, is proportional to products of pieces which are independent of one another. That is, you have statistical independence built into your logic and your thinking. That is the fundamental gut reason why this e to the minus beta h is the right answer. The derivation is going to take us a while. There are relatively simple derivations, one of which people in class told me about, but I'm going to come about it through looking at the dynamics of the system. That means I have to develop a lot of machinery before I get this. This is a result of the system being in equilibrium. Being in equilibrium means that lots of stuff has gone on. The system has been around for a while. Things have banged into one another. We then will have to develop the time dependence of the system to show how the equilibrium arises. But that's a fairly long story, which I'm going to go into in detail. In any case, a probability distribution exists in this form. You can also write the logarithm of the probability distribution. Of course, there's a z down here if I'm making probability distributions. The logarithm of the probability distribution is, of course, proportional to minus beta h. If I imagine changing the energy of something, then the change in the logarithm of the probability is minus beta times the change in energy. This fact that the probabilities change in this way is called detailed balance. Now, writing this equation, you can't see why it's called detailed balance, but it's obvious, or rather, I can tell you why it's called detailed balance. Let's imagine we have two systems, A and B, which are in contact with one another. This is what's happening to A. It's, as A transfers energy to B or vice versa, the change in probability in the configuration of A obeys this law. The same law is obeyed by B if they're in equilibrium. And you get exactly the same thing, except, of course, the sign of the energy change for B is different from the sign of the energy change for A. There is then a detailed balance in the amount of probability. And that's where the name comes from. Okay. I'm about to use this to design or to talk about computer programs using what are called Monte Carlo methods for calculating the behavior of systems in statistical equilibrium. I hit this button and I cross my fingers because I think that's enough. Something should happen up there eventually. Should, but it takes a while. says turn off here. That's the right thing to say. Because it says that something's on.
HDMI.
I got HDMI on. It's red. Can't be any redder than red. Isn't it wonderful having big out there, having being watched the world, so that there's somebody to help you when things go wrong? We think. The screen should be coming down. Yes. Yes, 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 yes. Thank you. And the lights should be coming low. And I should be plugged in here, so I should be seeing the screen. Maybe it takes a while. Hang on. Okay, I could tell you what I was going to be saying. I'm asking the question why we have this Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. The reason we have the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution is answered on this slide. In fact, it was answered right here, which is that A has a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution because B does, and B has a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution because A does, and they cooperate, each one of which transferring energy according to an exponential law. So imagine that we have systems. Now, this is not going to be true of all kinds of different systems. We need to have a Hamiltonian system. It's not going to happen that we have the right kind of probabilities in the Lorentz model. But if we have a Hamiltonian system, we can divide the phase space up into pieces and talk about the probability of coming from one so we divide into pieces of equal volume, and we talk about the probability of going from a piece of phase space labeled by gamma to another piece of phase space labeled by gamma prime, different piece of phase space, and we set things up so that these different pieces of phase space have the same volume. It's not supposed to be on. It's not on my screen, I don't think. No, it isn't on my screen, so I'll get rid of it. What do we do to get rid of it? There we go. Okay. Okay, this is a special property of classical mechanics. For example, not true of the Lorentz system. So that when you go from gamma to gamma prime, you have to gather up the energy to make the energy change. That gathering up the energy requires an extra factor of e to the minus beta times the energy. You may ask, what makes the energy special? Well, the energy is special because the energy is conserved. If we have other conserved things like momentum, well, we could put stuff in a box, momentum isn't conserved. Number of particles, yes, that is conserved. We have to put in factors for that, but at the moment, factors which look exactly like this, exponential factors of constants times the change in those other conserved quantities. But for now, we're going to be working only with the energy. And therefore, what we're going to talk about is having a situation in which going from gamma prime to gamma and going from backwards from gamma to gamma prime have identical probabilities except for a factor of that comes from gathering up the energy, a factor of e to the minus the change in energy divided by kT. I repeat, although not all of you are willing to accept this, that the fundamental reason that this is true for one system is that it's true for lots of systems. It is a sort of self-consistent law in which the various systems in equilibrium conspire to all do this. In any case, we're about to make use of this law. we have in our formulation of statistical mechanics now two basic ideas, that we calculate probabilities as e to the minus beta h, and that when we go from state to state, we use this e to the minus beta delta e factor in order to calculate the relative probability of going one way versus going the other way. I'm going to put this together in what is called the Monte Carlo computer program. That is a computer program which calculates something. I'm going to show you how to do that in the next slide. When the Monte Carlo computer program will then be used to calculate the probability distribution for a single spin. It makes for a pretty little picture, but a sort of a not terribly deep story. Then we're going to go on and do it for lots of spins arranged in a one-dimensional or two-dimensional Isaac model. It's basically the same calculation. Part of the story I'm telling you here in this class is that people working in physics, statistical physics, but also other parts in physics, can make their ideas be concrete by designing computer programs that show up their ideas. This idea of doing a computer simulation was not part of Maxwell's or Boltzmann's world. It has become part of our world in the second half of the 20th century and in the 21st century. However, it is an essential part of a science. Almost all calculations involve someone, well, that's a little excessive, but most calculations involve someone picking up a computer and checking his or her ideas by using that computer in order to generate a computer simulation. Now, here is a particular kind of program called a Monte Carlo program. I will describe it to you in more or less the language of computations. I suspect everyone here has designed a computer program at one time or another. If not, here's one. It's not hard. So what we're going to do is we're going to think of the system as being in the state gamma. This is not a real computer program. This is a sort of meta-computer program, but this is how computer programs are designed. We're going to go through a loop. That is, we're going to start here, end there. When we end, we go back to where we started from. We imagine doing that an arbitrarily large number of times until we get tired and want to look at the answer. So we start out with the system in the state gamma. We pick some other state of the system with equal probability, with equal volume in phase space at random. So we throw a set of dice to do that. That's why it's called the Monte Carlo calculation. Let del be 1 over kt times the energy difference between these two configurations. We are assuming that we're in statistical equilibrium, hence the factor of temperature. If del is less than zero, we set the state equal to gamma prime. We go to a new, we put the system, computer system in a new state, and we go back to where we started from. If del is greater than zero, we generate a random number, r, between 0 and 1. And if r is less than or equal to the exponential of this random number, we then change the state to gamma prime. If r is bigger than this random number, we don't do any change. And in fact, by doing this, we have implemented the equation, which is just too high for me to reach, the one that says that the probability of going from gamma prime to gamma is equal to the probability from going to gamma prime, except for an exponential factor. Do you all want to ask a question about this alleged sort of meta-computer program? All of this stuff is just a way of generating the condition that the probabilities of going in the two different directions are expressed by a factor of e to the minus beta times the energy change. This is one way of expressing it among many. It is the most common way in Monte Carlo calculations. Okay. I should do this on the blackboard. Too many buttons to push. I get confused. Lights on? Up? Yes, lights up. So I'm going to write on the blackboard what's on this slide here, but it's better teaching technique when you're doing something real to do it on the blackboard. The PowerPoint is not the way to do it. So imagine I'm going through this process. Imagine that I have a probability of being in state gamma at time t plus 1. T plus 1 is what just after I've completed one step of the loop. And this probability of being in state gamma at time t plus 1 is the result of being in all kinds of other possible states that I might have been in. I see a defect in my pedagogic technique. I have interchanged between these two slides what I call gamma and what I call gamma prime. Gamma is now the state after we've done things. Gamma prime is going to be pretty much the state before we've done things, but so be it. So now I want to calculate the change in the probability of being in the state gamma over the time interval one step in the calculation. In fact, if I wanted to calculate the change, I better make that change on the left-hand, better make the change on the left-hand side of the equation. So it's rho of gamma at time t plus 1 minus rho of gamma at time t that I'm after. Well, one kind of thing that can happen is that I could be in state gamma prime at time t, and then I could, that's a rho, this is a p. This p is not the pressure as it was 10 minutes ago. This p is the probability of going from gamma prime to gamma. This is one reason that the probability changes. This is one way, this is one term in the calculation of the change in the probability. What I am writing now is called the master equation. This describes how you might get more particles, more into the state gamma. But it can also pop out of the state gamma if it was initially in the state gamma. So you start out with a rho of gamma and t, which tells you what is the probability that you were initially in the state gamma. Then you have a probability of gamma prime going to gamma. That's the probability of going from, start out in gamma, you go to gamma prime, you get out of the state gamma, you end up in the state gamma prime, and this reduces the number of guys in the state gamma. This is now what is called the master equation. It tells you how this thing changes in time. It is expressed then in terms of these probabilities. So what do I want to do? I want to convince you that there is an equilibrium solution of the equation. That equilibrium solution of the form rho of gamma is e to the minus beta times the energy, which depends on gamma, divided by some partition function. And maybe I'm thinking of a simple system with a partition function small z, or a complicated system with a partition function capital Z. Can't tell from this. Well, what do you do in order to prove that this is the solution? You take this proposed solution, you plug it into the equation, you show that the right-hand side is 0, then the left-hand side is going to be equal to 0, then you are all done. So let me try to do that. I'm looking for equilibrium. I'm looking for the left-hand side to be 0. I claim that this is the correct equilibrium solution. I get a 1 over z here. I get a sum over gamma prime. And then stuff. P. Gamma prime goes to gamma times e to the minus beta times the energy as a function of gamma prime minus. P, gamma goes to gamma prime times e to the minus beta times the energy as a function of gamma. We're done. Except this should be a curly bracket. If this ratio of the two probabilities is e to the minus beta times the energy difference, we have satisfied the equation. This right-hand side is equal to 0. The left-hand side is then forced to be 0. This is an equilibrium solution. What I haven't proven for you, I have proven that this is the correct way of getting an equilibrium solution. I've hence proven that the Monte Carlo algorithm, which was on the previous slide, gives you the equilibrium solution as one possible solution. I haven't proven for you that all possible initial conditions goes to this equilibrium solution. It isn't, I can't prove it for you because it isn't true with just the assumptions I've made here. One needs to know something about these probabilities. In particular, if there were other conservation laws besides the conservation law for energy, it wouldn't be true. You may notice that the conservation law for energy may be built into the real dynamics of the system, but it's not built in here. Here, the energy of the thing changes as we go from step to step. The Monte Carlo, then, is a fake or wrong dynamics, which gives the right equilibrium. And there have been literally tens of thousands of different papers, in which, maybe even more, in which people have used this Monte Carlo method, as I outlined it for you here, in order to study the behavior of one system or another. It is a very quick and simple way of seeing what is going on in a system. So I'll let the light slow again. And I'm about to show you a computer calculation in which I look at one spin. There's the spin in a field represented by that h. There's the value of h we're going to work with. And we're going to see the magnetization, the average magnetization, that is the average of taking plus 1 when the spin goes this way, and minus 1 when the spin goes that way, calculating that average as a function of the number of steps in the calculation. We will go through 1,000 steps. And let me see whether I can make it work without everything collapsing. At least that makes it more interesting. The fact that we have the opportunity, the possibility for the whole computer thing to collapse in front of our, well, it's not in this one, so it's in lecture 2. And it's the zero-dimensional Ising model. And it's one spin. and it comes up, and I hit this button, and there it goes. Hey, way to go. Okay. Green means, and up means a spin pointing up. Red and down means the spin pointing down. This is a plot which is being done now in sort of real time for the calculation. I'll do it again. The different random numbers will have a different answer. This is a, let's get the, that's a plot which shows you the probability, that, no, it says probability, but in fact it is, yes, it is the probability. It's the probability that the spin will point upward as a function of computer steps averaged here over the number of computer steps. At the beginning, we had a few steps, and the average was not very closely equal to the average that you get from equilibrium statistical mechanics. In the end, with this value of h, which happens to be the log 2, you get an 80% probability that the spin will point up. And in fact, in the calculation, we came out with a 0.794 probability compared with a theoretical value of 0.8. I will do it once more. This calculation is barely interesting enough to do twice. So because the magnetic field points upward, we have the system pointing up more than it points down. We have a longer time that the green arrow is on and a shorter time that the red arrow is on. The green arrow is on roughly 80% of the time. Theoretical amount, if we ran this thing over an infinite number of steps, it should be 80%. Actually, it was 80.6%, and that's what the calculation is. I will spend just one more instant and show you that the computer program takes practically no space. That is the computer program done with all kinds of comments and stuff. Okay. So what we see here is that we can actually calculate the properties of statistical systems by using computer analysis. It's relatively easy to do and uses the idea of detailed balance. I'm going to turn off this topic in a second. I'm going to turn off the computer in a second. Do you guys want to ask any questions about it? Don't be so quiet. I could make more errors if you want me to, and then you'll make noise. In fact, probably as we get sort of towards the end and I get more tired, I will make more errors. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to change subjects entirely. We have said what there is to say about the statistical mechanics of, about the fundamentals of the statistical mechanics of simple systems. Through the late 19th and early 20th centuries, people calculated the statistical properties of atoms and molecules and other relatively simple things that you could calculate one excitation at a time. They did phonons, as you've been hearing in your field theory course. They did photons, they did atoms, they did molecules. In fact, these calculations were tremendously interesting because, why were they tremendously interesting? Because they gave them what people might, what they gave the wrong answer. That's the simple thing to say. You calculate the specific heat of a diatomic molecule, and you come up with, well, the diatomic, that means you have 6 degrees of freedom. That means you have a specific heat. That means you have an energy of 3 nkT, which means that you have a specific heat, which is 3K. Well, it's really 5/2 K. It's not 3K because of quantum mechanics. And the difference between classical mechanics, and which they knew all about, and quantum mechanics, which hadn't been invented before in the period I'm talking about, meant that all kinds of bad answers were obtained by doing classical calculations. The worst of those bad answers was, in fact, done by calculating the specific heat of a gas of photons. You take a cavity, box, you heat it up to a given temperature. That box fills with photons. You drill a little hole in the box to look in or let the photons come out. And you measure the flux of photons or you measure the energy density in the box. Because you have a number of modes, electromagnetic modes, which is infinite, and you're supposed to have 1/2 kT of energy per degree of freedom, you have what's supposed to be an infinite amount of energy in there, and indeed an infinite flux coming out. That's what classical mechanics and electromagnetic theory tell you. Well, not that way at all. You get a quite finite amount of stuff. You have an energy proportional to sigma T^4, sigma, known as the Stefan-Boltzmann constant, is measured quantity. It involves h-bar in the theory, but you measure it, it's a number. In any case, people were very concerned by these two things. The specific heat of gases was wrong, and the behavior of electromagnetic radiation, the statistical behavior of electromagnetic radiation, was wrong in classical mechanics. They thought they had made a small error. Nonsense. It turned out that they had made a huge error. The classical mechanics for the microscopics of the world is wrong. Classical mechanics will describe what happens perfectly well if I threw the eraser up in the air, but if I wanted to talk about the motion of an atom within that eraser, I better use quantum mechanics to get an accurate answer. If I want to talk about the behavior of photons in a cavity, I better use quantum mechanics. So there are tremendously interesting things happened to doing one particle analysis in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. But by the 1920s, this was mostly partially over. People had invented a rough form of quantum mechanics. Bohr and Sommerfeld had invented a rough form of quantum mechanics. By 1923, which is the year I'm going to talk about, people were about to invent a final form of quantum mechanics, Heisenberg, Dirac, Schrodinger. Off far away from there, there was a man by the name of Lenz, who was thesis advisor to a man by the name of Eisen. And they were interested in a different problem. Their problem was, how could you understand, how could you characterize the properties of a system containing many particles interacting all at the same time? This many-particle system has interesting properties that would like to understand and are hard to do from the beginning. In particular, they were interested in what was called a ferromagnet. Ferromagnet is a bunch of spins. I draw them out in a line, but imagine a hunk of iron which contains some 10 to the 20th spins, 23, 24. Imagine a hunk of iron which contains a huge number of spins. At low temperatures, these spins tend to line up. and produce a magnetic field. That's one possible situation. At high temperatures, the spins point every which way. That's another kind of situation. In fact, there is a sharp distinction between these two. There's a sharp change in behavior called a phase transition, which separates the low temperature phase in which the spins are mostly lined up from the high temperature phase in which the spins point every which way. This phase transition is interesting, and Lenz and Ising were interested in understanding it. They thought correctly that they weren't going to understand it by looking at one spin at a time. They're going to have to look at lots of spins in order to understand the phase transition. And they wanted to get a simplified model which would enable them to talk about lots of spins. Not that one. That one. Let's see if I can learn. Right is back. Okay, maybe I can learn. Now, the problem in designing a model is that you want a model that has the right amount of physics in it, not too much and not too little. The spins in a piece of iron are the result of the motion of electrons. At that time, in fact, the spin on electrons hadn't even been discovered, but they sort of knew that there was something with... That can't be so. I got a piece of history that I don't understand. But in any case, they sort of knew that what you could do was take a spin, like the Ising spin that we've been talking about up to now. In fact, of course, we call it an Ising spin because of Ising, who was the first to use it effectively. And they wanted something which was for which they could write a relatively simple and relatively analyzable Hamiltonian. So what they considered was a situation in which you have a bunch of spins lined up on a line. To get something simple, they considered a sum of n spins with couplings k. K describes the strength of the coupling between these guys. K is, in fact, a physical value of an energy divided by Boltzmann constant times temperature, the minus sign. Times the z component of the spin at one site, dotted into or multiplied by the z component of the spin at a neighboring site. They're going to use periodic boundary conditions in which the sigma n plus j is sigma j. You have anti-periodic boundary conditions in one of your homework assignments that has sigma n plus j is equal to minus sigma j, an interesting situation, but not the one we're going to analyze. And so this summation has the form sigma 1, k times sigma 1, sigma 2, plus, let me write it a little bit less space. What I wanted to write down explicitly was that the last guy on the chain is coupled to the first guy, making for a relatively simple, if slightly unphysical, problem. And we want to calculate the partition function, z, which is the sum over sigma 1 up to sigma n, e to the k sigma 1, sigma 2, k sigma 2, sigma 3, dot, 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 e to the k sigma n, sigma 1. More or less, Lenz gave this problem to Ising, or Lenz and Ising together invented this problem. This is a momentous occasion in the sense that they were for the first time inventing a problem which involved n particles and hoping to solve it. They didn't hope to solve it in general, but they thought that this one-dimensional problem might be within reach. Indeed, it is. I'm going to tell you how they solved it, and then I will tell you why the solution didn't turn out to be as interesting as they hoped, why it was that this problem did not show a phase transition, which they hoped it would. I have to tell you a little bit about the algebra of dealing with such spins. I told it in its own language. Okay. So we have to deal with an e to the k sigma times sigma prime, where the sigmas take on the value plus or minus 1. That simplification that you get plus or minus 1 as the possible values makes it possible to solve the problem. The real problem of ferromagnetism involves quantum mechanics and quantum mechanical spins and band theory and all kinds of ugly stuff. This is a nice simplification that enables you to attack it. And the simplification, part of the simplification which is crucial, is the fact that the variables take on precisely two values. There is a nice, pretty way, there are two nice, pretty ways in which we can write something like this, special for this thing, which isn't true in general for exponentials. It depends on the condition that sigma sigma prime squared is equal to 1. That means if we write out the series expansion, sum from I equals 1 to 0 to infinity of 1 over I factorial times k to the I sigma sigma prime to the I, then all the even terms is either equal to these. If I is even, this thing is equal to 1. And if I is odd, it is equal to sigma sigma prime. And that, in both cases, is a nice simplification. And so this is the sum over even I of 1 over I factorial k to the I times 1 plus sigma sigma prime times the sum over odd I 1 over I factorial k to the I. This thing is, in fact, the hyperbolic cosine. This thing is, in fact, the hyperbolic sine. And this is one of the two forms that I wanted. There is an alternative in which this is written as cosh k times 1 plus sigma sigma prime times the hyperbolic tangent of k. This is, of course, sort of trivial. if sigma sigma prime is equal to 1, cosh plus sinh is the exponential, and you get e to the k. If it's equal to minus 1, cosh plus sinh is e to the minus, is exponential of minus k, and you get e to the minus k. However, we're going to use this trivial fact in order to analyze the problem and, in fact, calculate this sum. It is also true, and this is another way of writing the same kind of thing, that there are two possibilities. Either sigma is equal to sigma prime, in which case this thing is 1 and this one is 0, or sigma is equal to minus sigma prime, in which case this thing is 1 and this thing is 0. That is, these are each projection operators that take on the value 0 or 1, depending on whether sigma equals sigma prime or sigma equals minus sigma prime. In fact, the expression I want is that when sigma equals sigma prime, this is e to the k. And when sigma is minus sigma prime, this is e to the minus k. These, now you have two trivial facts, not entirely trivial facts, but will enable us to say very important things about the Ising model. This could be written as 1 plus sigma sigma prime over 2 times 1 minus sigma sigma prime over 2 times e to the minus 2k. So I have now just enough time, I think, in order to solve and find the partition function of the one-dimensional Ising model. I am going to use this expression. Partition function. Sum over sigma 1 to sigma n. First, I get n factors of the hyperbolic cosine. I'm starting from here. First, I get n factors of the hyperbolic cosine. And then I get a whole bunch of factors of 1 plus sigma sigma prime times the hyperbolic tangent. I'll write out a few of those factors. Sigma 1, sigma 2 times the hyperbolic tangent of k. 1 plus sigma 2, sigma 3 times the hyperbolic tangent of k. Dot, 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 dot. 1 plus the hyperbolic tangent of k. 1 plus sigma n sigma 1 times the hyperbolic tangent. It is convenient for me to think of this as coming out with 2 to the n terms and the hyperbolic cosine of k raised to the nth power. And then thinking about the average of this whole thing. The average over sigma 1 and sigma 2 and sigma 3 and all the other sigmas. I will only calculate the average over sigma 2 because that will show us what is going on. Yes? I made a mistake. Catch me at my mistake. Please tell me where it is. I said we're doing a sum. That sum is over these spins. Well, I can think of the sum as also an average over the spins, but then I have to calculate, then I have to put in a factor of the total number of terms in the sum. I apologize. What I was doing is trivial, but I have to say it. Do this sum, I get 2 to the n terms, and now I take an average. The average of sigma 1 or sigma 2 or sigma 3, let me do sigma 2 specifically. The average for sigma 2 is, of course, 0. We're summing over, okay. There are two terms in the summation involving sigma 2, this term and this term. I can't have only one of the two terms. I have to have either none of them or both. So if I take this thing, which I've written down here, I can replace it by 1 plus sigma 1, sigma 3, times the hyperbolic tangent of k squared. And then I get the next term on, which is 1 plus the hyper sigma 2, sigma 3, sigma 4, times the hyperbolic tangent of k, and so forth. That is to say, each one of these sigmas either enters in this sum by itself, in which case it gives nothing, or it enters twice in two successive terms. If it's going to enter in two successive terms, we're going to get all of these terms. Every one of these hyperbolic tangents has to come in. The answer is, either we get all of the ones, or we get all of the hyperbolic tangents, but we get nothing else. I'll say that again slowly, but imagine multiplying out this sum. There are 2 to the n terms in this summation. There one term is special. It is a product of all ones. That gives, has an average, of course, which is 1. Another term is special. It is the product of all of the possible hyperbolic tangents. In that special term, each sigma enters precisely twice. Since sigma squared is 1, the average of sigma 2 squared is 1. In any term in which each sigma enters precisely twice, it is just as if we had it not there at all. This special term with the hyperbolic tangents raised to the nth power also gives us an answer. It gives us the answer hyperbolic tangent to the nth power times 1. And then that is the entire answer. Because as Isaac realized as he did his work and multiplied out this sum, every other term, for example, the term involving only the hyperbolic tangent here, that involves a sigma 1 and sigma 2. And if you have only one hyperbolic tangent, and only one sigma 1 and one sigma 2, that average is going to give us 0. The net result is that we have the answer for the partition function of the one-dimensional Ising model. The answer is that the partition function is 2 to the n times the hyperbolic cosine of k raised to the nth power, 1 plus the hyperbolic tangent of k raised to the nth power, which we can write as 2 to the n times the hyperbolic cosine of k to the nth power plus the hyperbolic sine of k to the nth power. And this is the answer. If you don't see what I've said about how those multiplications work out, take n equals 2 and then n equals 3 and do it for yourself. N equals 2 is easy. N equals 3 will give you the insight that you need to see how it works for all n, if you don't have it from the words I've produced. Now, this answer gives us a chance to talk about some important qualities of statistical mechanics. We are interested often in very large systems. The reason for that is that the world is filled with large systems. There are 10 to the 23rd or 10 to the 26th or something atoms in a reasonable sized hunk of material. That means that since the hyperbolic sine is always smaller than the hyperbolic cosine, or since the hyperbolic tangent for any real value of k is between 0 and 1, this term is 0 in comparison to this one. And in what is called the thermodynamic limit, the answer is 2 to the n times the hyperbolic cosine of k raised to the nth power. Almost all of you in your previous statistical mechanics or thermodynamics courses have bumped into the concept of intensive and extensive variables. Come on, it's this one. This one's the front one. No, maybe not. Middle one. This intensive means it's independent of n. We're describing a large system. An intensive variable is independent of n. For example, the pressure of the air in this room is an intensive variable. The density, the number of particles per unit volume, is an intensive quantity. The entropy density is an intensive quantity. Then there are extensive quantities. These are proportional to n. Entropy, energy, number of particles, and so forth. These are the two kinds of variables we use in the analysis of large systems. The partition function is neither extensive nor intensive. However, the logarithm of the partition function is. The logarithm of the partition function is proportional to n times something. And that something is minus beta times what is called the free energy. F, free energy. Often the symbol G is used. H, Helmholtz free energy. I forget whether it's a Gibbs or Helmholtz free energy, but one of those guys. The logarithm of Z is proportional to n. It is an extensive quantity. How come it comes out that way? Well, you see it here. It's something which is exponential in n plus a very small correction, and we forget about the very small correction. So the logarithm of z, in this case, is n times the logarithm of twice the hyperbolic cosine of the strength of coupling k. That answer was a grave disappointment to Ising and lens. This is a nice, smooth function of k. It has no interesting structure in it and doesn't change its behavior anyplace. Furthermore, it doesn't show any hint of a phase transition. I'm just trying to see whether I have enough time to put up a picture. I will draw the picture instead. If you look at, as a function of temperature, the specific heat of a ferromagnet, that is the derivative of the energy with respect to temperature, maybe it's fixed pressure. Here's a ferromagnet, like iron. Iron has a ferromagnetic transition, a transition from an ordered to a disordered state, so that at low temperatures it is ordered, high temperatures it is disordered, and at a critical temperature called the Curie temperature, it goes from one to the other. If you look at the specific heat of iron, it looks roughly like that. There is a sharp peak at the critical temperature. If you look at the derivative of this thing with respect to temperature, nothing interesting ever happens. There is no phase transition, no interesting behavior. Nonetheless, it's interesting for us to study this one-dimensional Ising model. It is the sort of the hardest problem we can solve all in 15 minutes. That's what we've done, 15 minutes to solve it. And it has in it a lot of structure. I'm going to start picking up on the structure next time. This time I'll write down the answers, however, just to get us started in the right direction. In the ferromagnetic state, there tends to be an ordering of the spins. The expectation value of the sigmas will turn out to be non-zero. In the Ising model, this average is zero. We can calculate it. In fact, it's trivial to calculate. I'm not going to do it now just because it's so easy. You won't believe it. You could also calculate, and I will do that next time, the average of two spins. In the case n goes to infinity, I calculate it in general, but the interesting result is the limit in which n goes to infinity. 0 is less than j, is less than j plus n, which is much less than n. So what you see is a bunch of spins separated by a distance n. And then the answer turns out to be of the form of an exponential of minus the distance between the two sites, between the places where the spins are measured, divided by some distance. Imagine that we have a physical lattice and that along the lattice we have separation between sites, physical sites separated by a, and so exponential of minus na divided by some characteristic distance. That characteristic distance is called the coherence length. It goes to infinity as the temperature goes to zero, but unlike in a problem in which there's a phase transition, it is finite for all finite values of the temperature, and that too suggests that there is no phase transition. In any case, next time we will pick up on and solve the Ising model. We will show how it can be converted into a problem in quantum mechanics. We'll solve we will show how this can be calculated. We will then talk about the two-dimensional Ising model, get the properties of the solution, including the properties of its phase transition, and see a little bit about renormalization into the next lecture. We will do simple-minded sort of phenomenological renormalization on the one-dimensionalizing model and then also on the two-dimensionalizing model. Are there questions about what I did today? Yes, please.
Did you assume that spins were independent in the first in the derivation?
I'm sorry, which derivation? We haven't
found it. When you took the average on sigma 2.
There is, if you talk about the averages, what you're doing is basically averaging independently over sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3. All of the correlations that might exist between them are in that e to the k sigma, the factor is e to the k times sigma. That's where all the correlation is, and the sum you do, the things are independent. So the answer to your question is yes. Yes, please.
Was there another motivation for it, or is it simply motivated by the fact that you get the right distribution if that gives the right physics? Or...
I'm trying to think back to what I know about the people who invented it. This was invented by Metropolis and Stein and Teller in the early days of the Los Alamos Nuclear Weapons Laboratory. They had computers, and they wanted to know the properties of materials, particularly, probably, of plutonium metal. And they wanted to be able to do calculations of material properties. They had, at that time, no good way of doing any calculations on a computer of the numerical properties of stuff. So they more or less said to themselves, wouldn't it be nice if we had a fake dynamics, simpler than the dynamics of real systems, which nonetheless gave the proper equilibrium properties? Let's invent a fake dynamics. The dynamics then of the time dependence of Monte Carlo is not at all interesting. It is not the right dynamics for the system. However, the result is interesting. The result is the correct equilibrium properties. Now, this is a reflection of a very important conceptual point. For Hamiltonian systems, if I'm interested only in the equilibrium, it does not matter much what dynamics I use, because all dynamics lead to the same equilibrium. No one need tell you whether or not there was a particular interaction in calculating the equilibrium properties of the air in this room. The equilibrium properties are what they are, not because of the history of the air, but because e to the minus beta h is the correct description of the probabilities. If e to the minus beta h comes out from anything you're doing, it's the right answer and you can be happy. And indeed, Metropolis, Stein, and Metropolis work is probably the most quoted paper in physics. Yes, please.
You mentioned the thermodynamic limit. Z diverges wildly in that.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand. You might have to speak up a little louder.
Sorry. You mentioned the thermodynamic limit is when the limit is n goes to infinity.
Yes.
But our partition function diverges incredibly quickly in that limit. So how does the limit actually work?
What you're supposed to do is calculate the logarithm of the partition function. When I was taking statistical mechanics, my teacher was shocked by the idea that when you did calculations of the partition function, you could get the wrong answer by doing all kinds of simple-minded approximations because the partition function was so wildly dependent on n. If you know from the beginning, if you use from the beginning the fact that the logarithm of the partition function is extensive, then you will get answers out easily and accurately. If you don't use that fact, you can run into trouble with approximations and all kinds of difficulties. So my advice is take logarithms first and calculate second. Further questions? Onward to phase transitions tomorrow.